And the subject of Lecture 12 is Population, Technology, and Economic Change in China's History. What we're doing here is we're taking a next step on the subject of the previous lecture. We're asking the question, how do these large factors of population change, institutional setting, and possibly environment, though I don't actually have a slide on environment, how do these large factors play into good explanations of economic change and sustained economic development? So today, this lecture is kind of continuing the Eurasian comparisons subject of the previous lecture. And it is also focusing on a couple of large and, I think, important controversies in the United States, but also United States and China right now. In other words, theoretical disagreements about how to interpret, especially Chinese economic history. The debate that I will be referring to is called the involution debate. And there actually is a slide, so I don't need to write it on the board. The involution debate. And it has turned into a really substantial and continuing and sustained debate. So you could say the big question is, what are the large economic factors which explain sustained economic growth? And I would like to take a minute to give a brief statement of what sustained economic growth is. You could say that every society has economic change. At any given time, there is some degree of change. So what do we mean by sustained economic growth? We mean structural change to an economic system leading to a significant change in the rate of growth of output, standard of living, incomes, productivity, and maybe that's it. So output, productivity, income, and standard of living. What people refer to as sustained modern economic growth is an inflection point in a graph where the most important economic variables begin moving upward. So standard of living begins rising, productivity of manufacturing or productivity of agriculture begins changing, begins improving. And each of those is happening at a rate greater than the rate of population increase. I mentioned in the first half of today's presentation that the long period of Chinese agricultural development from, let's say, 1300 to, let's say, 1800, so 500 years of Chinese agricultural development, that was the graph that I drew. The average standard of living for the peasantry remained roughly constant in that period of time. And you might say, therefore, no change. Chinese agriculture was, quote, stagnant. You might say that, but it would be incorrect to say, because there was a lot of population growth in that period of time. And so even to stay level required improvement in land productivity, improvement in techniques of production, improvement of new crops. Do you know that there was substantial change in the cropping, in the crops that were grown in China from 1300 to 1800? There were new rice varieties, for example, that were imported into China from Burma and Southeast Asia. In 1300, there was kind of a rice revolution, which in which new varieties, I mean, they're not new today, but in 1300 they were new. New rice varieties were imported, which had higher yields. There were new crops that were introduced. The sweet potato, which was introduced from the Americas, and it was introduced, I believe, into North China. So the sweet potato became a new crop which produced a lot of calories, and therefore could become a staple crop and could be grown in areas where wheat could not be grown and rice could not be grown. So introduction of new crops was another way of improving agricultural productivity in that period of time. Application of more labor, so multiple cropping, having both grain and fruit trees, or grain and peppers, or grain and tomatoes, having, in other words, intercropping, where you have multiple crops growing at the same time, or also multiple crops in a season, or in a full year. So you may have two seasons of crop, or two and a half seasons, three one year, two the next year. In other words, all of those are innovations in agriculture, which led to rising output. But it happened that rising output was just about equal to rising population. So all of this agricultural innovation that happened between 1300 and 1800, it all was absorbed by the rising level of population. Anyway, so the question is, what explanations can we offer of major economic transformation, by which people usually mean substantial and sustained growth in incomes per capita, growth in productivity, and increasing application of new technologies, new crops, and new ways of producing. So what are the explanations? Rising level of technology and labor skill, that would be one possible explanation. Population dynamics in the family system. This is a very important social factor, whether you're interested in economic growth or you're interested in other things. The population dynamics are tremendously important, and the nature of the family, the nature of the social circumstances in which people have children, those arrangements lead to different characteristics of population growth. And at any given time, we're interested in the absolute size of the population, we're interested in the rate of growth. A 2% rate of growth is a tremendously high rate of growth. There are European countries like Italy, which right now are experiencing negative growth. And I believe that the Chinese population is at essentially zero population growth, or maybe just slightly positive population growth. So the rate of growth is an important variable. And then, of course, fertility and mortality rates. Now, all of this is pretty interesting to dive into. A society which has abruptly changed its standard of health, for example, if a society substantially improves its infant mortality statistics, what is the consequence likely to be? It is likely to be a period of rapid population increase, because infant mortality is pushed down. Fertility patterns are at the old level, and therefore population increase is rapid. This is called the demographic transition in economic development circles. It's a period of time with high fertility, low mortality, and therefore rapid population increase. Anyway, these demographic variables are very important. A third set of questions have to do with the institutional setting, whether it's the governmental setting or the property system in the form of land tenure. So in other words, if you were Philip Huang, and you were interested in, as he is and was, in the family peasant economy of North China in late imperial times, you would be interested in knowing what are the technologies that are in place, what are the crops that are in place, what are the patterns of cropping that are used, how is labor employed, whether draft animals are employed, how much market versus self-consumption is in place. You'd be interested in the economic characteristics of farming. That would be one thing. You'd be interested in knowing what are the population dynamics of the region, and you would be interested in knowing what are the local and governmental organizations and institutions. We would also then want to know things like the overall performance. What is the output? What is the total amount of grain and animal production? What is the productivity? What are the wages and prices? What is the standard of living? And how are each of these variables changing? This would be an overall snapshot of the nature of economic development at a particular time. I referred to Philip Wong. Philip Wong has written quite a bit of important work about the North China peasant economy, which he based on studies which were done in the 1930s, looking backward. So that Wong makes historical inferences from the 1930s to the economy before the 1930s and tries to estimate many of these variables and then tries to offer an institutional analysis of why the North China peasant economy had the economic development characteristics that it had. Wong is the author of another book, which is about South China. It's about the rice economy of South China. And in that book, he puts forward a very striking thesis. His thesis is that Chinese economic development, and as a matter of fact, he says this about all of China, though the data is based on South China, but he says that Chinese economic growth from the 1300s to the 1900s was what he calls involutionary. That is, it occurred as a result of more and more application of labor to agriculture. So I should explain that idea. But as population pressure rose, as the total amount of land was constant, then it may be that the average land per household was, on average, in South China, 8 mu per household. As population rises, the average land per household begins to fall. So it is 7 mu, 6.5 mu. Over a 100-year period of time, there is a decline in the average land available per family. And then the question is, what happens to those families? Do they begin to starve? Or is there innovation in agriculture in some way which leads to more output? Because if, you know, if let's say in 1500, the average standard of living for South China peasants was just about subsistence at 8 mu per household. If in 100 years the average land has fallen to 6.5 mu per household as a result of population increase, then either people have fallen below subsistence, or there is substantial import of food, or there has been change in productivity of land. Well, it is Philip Wong's view that there was one standard Chinese strategy, and that was involution. It was to apply more and more labor to the land, leading to a rising output per hectare, but leading also to a falling output per man day. So involution refers, this is an important concept, involution refers to a process of agricultural change which successfully produces more food, but at the cost of applying more and more labor to the agricultural process. Now, how can you apply more labor to the process? You can use more time of children and father and mother, more time in things like weeding, application of fertilizer, application of more intensive irrigation, application of more cropping, extending the season. So instead of it being a September through April process, it is an August through June process with multiple crops. Each of those is an innovation that produces more crops, but at the expense of more labor time committed. And it's Wong's view is that this is the primary way through which, the primary means through which Chinese economic progress occurred. More and more intensive application of labor, less and less reward per unit time, but sustaining at a subsistence level. I've told that story through the lens of agricultural activity, but our little discussion about proto-industrialization is also a story about involution, because proto-industrialization basically occurs because the peasant family has gotten about as much grain as it can get out of its farming activities, but it still has the evening, and instead of sitting around drinking tea and having a good time, the family can expend its labor time with skillful fingers making little objects for sale. That is a way of using more time to produce a little bit of money, and Huang makes the point that that proto-industrial activity is very low productivity. The additional income that comes to the family as a result is tiny, but his point is every little bit helps, and it always makes sense to spend a little bit more time to get even a tiny additional benefit in rice and money. In other words, his view is that the Chinese economy had a structural deficiency or a structural challenge, and that is that there was only one avenue of enhancing productivity of resources, and that is to spend more and more labor time to make more use of land, more use of tools, more use of other resources. That's what involutionary growth involves. So involutionary growth is a process through which a population or a village or a family does in fact create more product, but only at the expense of maybe doubling the amount of labor time that it expends. So if you pictured mentally two graphs, then one might be output per hectare or output per mu, and that graph is gradually moving upward. So you've got that graph in your mind. But the graph of output per labor day is gradually falling. Output per labor day is falling. And according to Huang, in times of stress, output per labor day abruptly and dramatically falls. So families are working more and more time in order just to keep even in terms of the total amount of grain being produced. So that's an interesting theory. It kind of conforms with the presupposition about the Chinese economy that it is a labor-abundant economy. But is Huang's theory true? And this has created a huge controversy in the United States. The historian to whom I referred earlier, Kenneth Pomerantz, has argued that actually Chinese labor was just about as productive in 1600, just about as productive as English labor. In other words, he makes the point that Chinese labor in 1600 in farming was not heavily exploited. It was moderately exploited. And secondly, he takes the view that over time, that labor productivity did not tend to fall. Between 1600 and 1800, labor productivity remained about constant. That is Pomerantz's view. And Pomerantz furthermore suggests there's a gap there. If population is going up, if labor productivity is constant, then the only way you could have more food output is if there is some kind of innovation occurring. And it is Pomerantz's view that yes, indeed, there were innovations occurring. Agriculture was getting finely tuned. New ways of cultivating were being discovered. That, in other words, there were productivity enhancements which made up the difference. So labor stayed about the same level of productivity. Land productivity rose, and technology improvement or farming improvement made up the difference. This is a very hot debate between these two figures, and if you want to read angry words, you can read the several essays in the Journal of Asian Studies in which Huang attacks Pomerantz. 60 pages is a very long journal article in the United States. Huang's review of Pomerantz's book is 60 pages, and then Pomerantz replies to this review with another 60 pages. There are two or three other essays which chime in, so it became a very lively debate. Fortunately, the debate is coming to some closure because we now have better data about labor productivity, standard of living, and so forth. And so it is possible now to sort out who's right and who's wrong. And it appears to me that the data seems to suggest that Huang's involutionary theory is incorrect. seems to show that farm productivity was not falling, or farmer productivity, labor productivity was not falling during this period. So here's a statement of Huang's position, that the agricultural economy experienced very low level per capita productivity and increased output only at the expense of ever increasing input of labor per unit of output. That is the theory of involution. So if you wanted a simple statement, that's it. So farmers increase output only by adding substantially more labor to the process, driving down the average and the marginal productivity of farm labor. That distinction between average and marginal is an important one. Marginal product, I was explaining during the break, the marginal product of an activity is the amount of additional product you get by one additional input of effort or other kinds of input. So for example, if you spent 10 hours reading the materials in this course and you got to this level of understanding of the materials, the marginal product of one additional hour would be the additional understanding that you get by spending one more hour of study. If you're a peasant farmer and your family as a whole spends 75 hours cultivating grain and on average produces 200 kilograms of grain, then spending one additional hour might produce one additional kilogram. The marginal product then is one additional kilogram of grain. The involutionary theory implies that farmers will expend more and more labor time up to the point where the marginal product approaches zero. So in other words, if you take a lantern, if you take a candle out to the field at midnight and look for bugs, that's a way of enhancing output. Using your candle, looking for the bugs, you can spend another hour, but the marginal benefit of that is very, very tiny, because that's not a very efficient way of killing pests. Nonetheless, if you're really at the level of subsistence, it may be worthwhile. But his point is the peasants will spend more and more labor time up to the point where the labor time marginal product is about zero. There's a Russian economist who wrote in the 1930s. His name is Chayanov. And he really is the author of the theory of involution. He called it the theory of peasant self-exploitation. Peasant self-exploitation, in which he argued that Russian peasant families used all the family's labor, extending it on cultivation and other forms of economic activity, out to the point where the marginal product approached zero. Send the children out to look for yet more bugs, because bugs eat a little bit of crop. Well, the marginal product is very little, and yet it is rational for the peasant family to do that. Rational because they have to support the children anyway. They have to have food enough for the children, so there's no cost to that marginal hour. But there is a little bit of benefit, and therefore it is rational to spend it. Think about this, though. If the peasant labor economy depended on wage labor, if I am a peasant farmer, and I have my own labor and my wife's labor, but the children go to school, so they don't labor, let's just assume that, and therefore the additional labor that I need, I get by hiring labor. Well, hired labor has a cost, and so I would never hire another hour of labor if the marginal product were not more than the cost of the wage. In other words, what we could refer to as a managerial farm, a farm using wage labor, its use of labor will be very, very different, because it will not extend labor out to marginal product equals zero. It will extend labor out to marginal product equals wage. That's a very different expenditure of labor and a very interesting institutional difference. It is interesting, I mentioned Chayanov. Chayanov was a victim of Stalinization, of Stalin. He was an important thinker in the 1920s and 30s in Russia, thinking about how communism and agriculture could fit together. And he was also the person who theorized, or one of the people who theorized, that peasant cooperatives would be a sensible and rational way of establishing socialism in agriculture. cooperatives as opposed to collectives. This was not a theory that the Stalin camp liked, and in fact, Chayanov died, you know, in a concentration camp. Robert Allen is an economist, economic historian. He's a farm historian that I've mentioned earlier today. And in his work, he does just an outstanding job of giving estimates of the nature of the English farm economy in order that we can then use Chinese estimates by people like Bo Zhonghui, who writes about the Yangtze River Delta, or Philip Huang. We can now compare level of productivity, level of inputs, and standard of living on the basis of these very good estimates of both English and Yangtze river farming. What Robert Allen finds is that he finds against Philip Huang, against the involutionary theory, he thinks that labor productivity was not falling, it was also not rising. In other words, it was essentially constant. So the comparison of the standard of living across Eurasia, that turns out to be a really interesting subject, but also one which has generated some important new results. The most important thing is that people in the West have generally assumed, as bad as things were for English farmers in 1600, Chinese farmers were much worse off. American and English and European economic historians have assumed that, and that appears not to be true. It appears that the best estimates would indicate English farmers and Chinese farmers, Yangtze River Basin and the core regions of agriculture in England, that the standard of living was about equal in 1600. Okay, now we're turning to, that was an analysis of what did the expenditure of labor look like? Was Chinese growth involutionary or not? And as I say, this has been a hot controversy, and I believe that the controversy is now sorting out to say Chinese growth was not involutionary. Let's turn now to institutions. How did institutions differ in Europe and in China? And I single this out because it's an important area of discovery in contemporary economic history. What we are finding is that Chinese and European state institutions and local institutions were quite different. In some cases, they were designed to accomplish similar goals, but the institutional arrangements were quite different. And so we can assess what was the effect of state institutions, for example, that centralized granaries in Qing times. The state took on the responsibility of averting famine. The European state did not take on that responsibility. And so we can ask the question, what were the economic consequences of greater famine security in China than in Europe? That's an important contrast. I have asserted throughout, when I've talked about micro-foundations, when I've talked about causal realism, when I've talked about rational choice, I've asserted that paying attention to the institutional context is absolutely critical. We need to know what is the institutional setting, what is the landlord-peasant relationship, what is the taxation relationship, what is the property-owning relationship. We need to know the details of those institutions in order to know how people will behave, and therefore in order to know what the pattern of development will be. And so institutions of land ownership, taxation, control of labor, these are particularly important, and economic history needs to pay a lot of attention to them. And then the economic historian can do aggregative explanation. He can go from the setting, what we were talking about really about proto-industrialization. Proto-industrialization is an institution for the merchant and also for the household, and it gives a set of incentives to both household and merchant. And then we can kind of work forward. What are the aggregate consequences of such an institution? Well, that's exactly what economic history explanations do. A particularly important issue is the issue of surplus. There is the theory, a very powerful theory in economic history. It is the theory of Mark Elvin that we'll be talking about in just a minute, but of several others as well. Surplus. Where does it come from? Who gets it? Who controls it? What can it be used for? If you thought there was no surplus in a given society, then the issue of surplus is not an issue. But it is, well, okay, so that's a statement. If you think there is no surplus, then you don't need to ask the question, where does the surplus go? Because there isn't one. If, on the other hand, in a given form of agriculture, a given form of economy, you think there is a surplus, then you can ask, who controls the surplus? For what purposes? Now, if you're interested in modernization of agriculture or manufacturing, control of the surplus is very important because the surplus is the source of investment funds for creating a new irrigation system, a new system of cropping, having the capital or the cash necessary to purchase fertilizers, modern technology fertilizers. In other words, surplus is a critical element in possible modernization or possible improvement of economic activity. And so we can ask, was there a surplus in traditional China? Was there a surplus in traditional England? And who controlled it? Robert Brenner, the economic historian of Europe and France, Robert Brenner argues English agriculture did in fact produce a surplus. It was taken in the form of a rent. The rent was held by managerial modernizing farmers, and those modern farmers in England were then had an institutionally defined incentive to put investment back into their land. They then increased the productivity of land, and that's what led to agricultural revolution in England. So in other words, Brenner's view is that there was a happy relationship between surplus extraction and modernization. The people who expropriated or captured the surplus were also the people who had an interest in modernizing agriculture. So they then had the investment funds necessary, and they put those investments to good use in modernizing agriculture. Huang argues that landlords in China did not have that incentive. Huang argues, yes, there was a surplus, it was small, and it was captured by landlords who had an interest in tea houses, in office, and in conspicuous consumption, but they did not have an interest in modernizing agriculture. That's Huang's thesis. Well, what is the rural surplus? Was there a rural surplus? Or did population increase essentially eat up all of the surplus or potential surplus? And here there's some data that is both pre-revolution and post-revolution data. But the bottom line is that even with China's large rural population, the best estimates are at the end of the Qing, into the Republican period, into the Communist period, the rural surplus was potentially 25 to 35%. That's a pretty interesting finding. 25 to 35% of the grain produced or the wealth produced in the countryside in China was surplus over and above the subsistence needs of the farmers. And then the question is, where did it go? These authors that I quote, Riskin and Lippitt, point out that the surplus went to landlords, to lenders, and to labor hiring managerial farmers. So let's look at each of those categories. Landlords, if I'm a tenant farmer and you are my landlord, I pay a rent to you, and the rent is at least partially part of the surplus which I've produced. So I produce a crop which I either directly consume or I sell in the marketplace. I pay a rent to you, and that rent is at least partially the surplus that's created through the farm activity. So that's kind of straightforward. What about lenders? Where do lenders come into the picture? Well, in order for me to be able to get through the crop year, there will come a time when I need to borrow in order to buy grain to feed my family. There will also come a time when I need to borrow in order to buy fertilizers. And so lenders play an economically important role within the rural economy, but they are also then able to take part of the surplus in the form of interest. Taxes are certainly a part of surplus extraction. I don't know why I didn't even mention taxes in this bullet. But labor hiring managerial farmers, that's another interesting category. What is a managerial farmer? It's a person who runs a farm as a capitalist enterprise in the sense that he's rational about the cost of inputs and the value of the outputs. He is a labor hirer at the times when he needs to have extra labor. And he is rational in the use of hired labor, meaning he doesn't hire a worker for 100 yuan if the benefit from using that labor is only 90 yuan. He will purchase labor only at a time when the benefit of expending that additional labor is more than the cost of the wage. And as I suggested a few minutes ago, that's a very important economic distinction. But the upshot of this is that the managerial farmer is able to capture the surplus himself because he is in control of the land, can purchase labor, and then has the total crop available, which he can use for his own subsistence and also sale for the purpose of creating a profit. Many authors, both Huang and also Victor Lippitt, assert that Chinese land ownership favored the landlord. The landlord used the surplus for luxury consumption, not investment. This is a central thesis in Huang's account and also in other economic analysts' account, so that agricultural development did not achieve substantial increase in productivity. It's not that the countryside could not fund increases in productivity. It's that those funds were being expropriated or being captured by a landlord class which was not interested in productivity, rather was interested in luxury consumption. So Chinese institutions, according to this analysis, assigned rural surpluses to income holders who refrained from investment in innovation, which is then to make a comment about Mark Elvin, but we're not yet ready for Elvin because we haven't talked about Elvin. So let's now turn to, we've now talked about two subjects, and this previous subject was the subject of land relations and local institutions. Let's now turn to population, which is, you know, really kind of the main theory which economic historians have offered of Chinese economic development. Mark Elvin is an economic historian who wrote a book called Patterns in the Dust, Patterns in the Dust, Patterns of the Past, a book which is an analysis of Chinese rural and rural agricultural development. But his basic view is that China had come to what he calls a high-level equilibrium trap. His view is not Huang's view that Chinese agriculture was inherently low productivity. His view instead is it was about optimal productivity. The Chinese agriculture had been very finely tuned, almost to a garden farming system, where there was almost no additional capacity for growth. And yet, the population had grown to the size where there was no surplus that would allow you to take a new technology step forward. So a high-level equilibrium trap is one where population growth has exhausted the feasibility of further productivity improvement without scientific breakthrough. And I believe I have a chart here. This is a pretty interesting chart. It's also in the essay that you read. But you can look at each of the heavy graphs, heavy curves, as being, we're looking at time moving across from left to right, and each of the heavy curves is the production possibility frontier, the production possibility of a certain form of agriculture. And the fact that they are upward sloping but gradually tailing off, what that fact represents is that at a given stage of agriculture or of a technology, you can adjust and tweak the technology to make it more productive, but over time, the enhancements that you can get are less and less. That's what the meaning of the fact that the growth, the graph slopes downward, not literally downward, but its slope is declining over time, so that as you move from these data points, we're moving closer and closer to the maximum feasible productivity of a given technology. But then we can have a significant technology breakthrough, which pushes us up to the next set of curves. And so we kind of make our way, leapfrog across refinement of technology within a given technology to the next technology, and then refinement within that technology, and yet to the next technology. The line here, the straight line, represents subsistence. At a given level of population, this is the level of output that is required to supply that population. And so whenever the lines cross the subsistence line, this point here, for example, see where I am, P13 here, at that point, we're below subsistence, so the total amount of product is not quite sufficient to satisfy the subsistence needs of the population. So we need to improve productivity, and sure enough, before we got to that point, we moved from this point here up to this point here, and now this, we have a whole series of improvements that are possible, but they're all bringing us back to the point where output equals total subsistence needs. But fortunately, we have another breakthrough. The high-level equilibrium trap is the point at which there are no further technology improvements available within the traditional technology set. And therefore, we get to this point here, right here, which is referred to as ET, the technology trap, or high-level technology trap. It's the point where we've refined existing technology with every bit of refinement that's possible. The population has grown to the point where that technology is totally exploited, and there are no further developments that are available. In other words, no further refinements are available. Elvin describes that as a high-level equilibrium trap. And he thinks that China, traditional Chinese agriculture in, say, 1600, was caught in such a trap. Why is it a trap? It is, if you had investment funds, you could say, well, let's invent tractors, and let's have much higher productivity agriculture. The problem is that if you're at this point, ET, you don't have the investment funds that are necessary in order to finance the science and technology research. Now, this is a really powerful mode of economic history analysis, and as a matter of fact, I have used this graph to explain what's happening to manufacturing in Detroit. We can use this same graph to explain the series of improvements in the labor process which have led to a situation where there are no further improvements possible, and yet the production process is not a profitable one. That seems to be true of manufacturing in Detroit, where I come from. In other words, it's a very powerful analysis, but again, the question is it true? And I've got things a little bit out of order here, because the point about surplus, if Lippitt and Riskin are correct in saying the Chinese economy throughout the Qing, throughout the Republican period, had a 25% surplus, well, that then demonstrates that China was not at a high-level equilibrium trap. It did have a surplus, but unfortunately, the surplus was not going back into the investments that would be necessary to jump out of this trap. So you might say it wasn't an absolute lack of surplus trap, it's rather the surplus was going to the wrong place, and therefore investment funds were not available to make the next technology breakthrough. Okay, a final series of topics having to do with the Malthusian question. The Malthusian question, Malthus, the 18th century economist, who wrote about population and economy, Malthus thought that population inevitably consumed all of economic activity, all of economic output. He famously said that population increases geometrically, whereas resources increase linearly, which means that there's always a tendency for there to be too much population for available resources. And he, in particular, thought that what that means is that population will have to be controlled. And there are only two ways of doing it. One is voluntarily, through an economic system, basically economic demographic system, where people increase their families only when they have the economic opportunity. So if, for example, you could only have a child, if in England, let's say, you could only have a child when you had a secure standard of living, a job or a craft or whatever, in that case, there would be an automatic break on population. When times are bad, fewer children, so population slows down. When times are good, more population and more economic positions are taken. Malthus believed that that was, in fact, how the European population worked, but he believed that the Chinese population worked differently. He believed the Chinese population was not constrained by economy, and therefore what he called positive checks, meaning famine, war, and other forms of increased mortality, would be the control of the Chinese population. Well, this is, again, an interesting subject, and historians, including in particular James Lee and several other historians, have now done incredibly powerful work of historical demography and have discovered that Chinese demographic patterns were not Malthusian. What he finds is that there were different controls on Chinese population, but that birth spacing, for example, the average years between a first child and a second child, that spacing was longer in China than it was in Europe. The average age of the first birth for a female, that age was older in China than in Europe. In other words, what James Lee and his collaborators have found is that China did indeed have a different demographic process, but it did not work through excess mortality. It did work through controlling fertility in terms of birth spacing and the age of the age of first birth. And furthermore, James Lee asserts that China's demographic process was in fact stable and resulted from controlled fertility. What that means is that there was a good relationship between population increase and farm productivity increase. So James Lee disagrees with the idea that there was a Malthusian crisis in China. Implicitly, that is to also disagree with the Mark Elvin theory of the high-level equilibrium trap. And James Lee asserts that more detailed study of the demographic systems at the level of the family result in very similar outcomes to those experienced in early modern Europe. In other words, the demographic profile of the Yangtze Valley population, that demographic profile was very similar to the profile of England in the same period of time. This project, which I'm describing, is a really interesting example from the point of view of our themes of philosophy of social science. It's an example of large social science investigation. There are something like 12 teams investigating demography all the way from Finland to Japan, doing very detailed and very sophisticated analysis of demographic records in order to have a real fine description of the demographic patterns of these sites all the way across Eurasia. One of the sites that James Lee investigates is a complete set, well, a very extensive set of Banner family records, the Qing, whatever they're called, lords or soldiers or whatever, Qing soldiers called Banner soldiers. Their family records are very detailed, and so it is possible to estimate fertility, mortality, and other life outcome variables on the basis of these linked sets of Banner family records. These data, these results are now being published in a series of books, and I think the results are just really incredibly important. So their goal is to come up with a micro picture of individual level demographic events with various characteristics, and then to put together a timeline of stress, when prices were high, when drought occurred, when famine occurred, in order to see what the relationship is between stress, economic stress, nutritional stress, and demographic outcomes. This also permits them to do some causal analysis of the role that institutions and social networks and institutional arrangements like the famine system that the Qing Empire embodied, to see what the results of those institutional arrangements were for the development of different demographic patterns. And so the James Lee population investigations provide what you might call a quantitative basis for evaluating the Malthusian theory of population. And the quantitative basis does show, evidently, that Malthus was wrong, basically. Malthus was incorrect in his theory of Chinese population, that the Chinese demographic system was one which did, in fact, control fertility. And I think we can stop there. So here the content of this lecture was to look at three big controversies about the explanation of Chinese economic development. Population was one, institutions and surplus were a second, and technology change and the interaction between farming and agriculture and technology was the third. In my mind, it's a really interesting range of topics. In this course in particular, it's interesting because it touches on the one hand, the history of China that you know through your own background, and on the other hand, it touches on some really powerful theories, social theories, which are offered as explanation of important outcomes like agricultural change and population growth and famine and so forth. Okay.